Listener supported. WNYC Studios. But I know
I can't live without my radio. LL Cool J wasn't the only one who couldn't live without his boombox. I'm John Schaefer, and coming up on Soundcheck, it's day three of a series we're calling Super Collectors, and we'll talk with a photographer who's collected dozens of vintage boomboxes. Plus, a super collector who owns 500 copies of the same album. Later. Collecting rave reviews has become something of a hobby for this sax player, Ben Wendell. A member of the jazz rock outfit Kneebody, he's set to release his second solo record called Frame. We'll hear some of it when Ben Wendell and his band play live. All of that on Soundcheck after the news. By day, they're mild-mannered civilians. But when the world's in trouble, they become super collectors. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today, more in our week-long series on large and unusual music collections. And later, a live performance from jazz saxophonist Ben Wendell and his band. On this third day of our celebration of super collectors, we're going to hear about two of the more unusual collections we've come across. Not necessarily the largest, but among the most unusual, as I say. We'll talk with a vinyl record enthusiast who owns 500 copies of the same album. Find out which one in a bit. But joining me first is Lyle Owerko, a New York-based photographer who collects boomboxes. Those massive, but allegedly portable, radio and cassette players that dominated American street corners in the 70s and 80s. Lyle owns more than 50 of them. He recently documented the history of the so-called ghetto blaster in a book called The Boombox Project. Lyle, welcome to Soundcheck.
Good afternoon.
So 50 doesn't, or 50 plus, doesn't seem like an enormous number, but some of these things were really expensive back in the day, weren't they?
Absolutely. Boombox was price of a really good guitar at the time. It was equatable and very much a musical instrument in its own right.
So what were the high-end boomboxes going for?
$800 to $1,000, probably $1,200.
Wow.
You're talking about the Sharp GF-777 or...
of course I am, yes.
Which was, a four-speaker beast with two cassettes, really...
And required its own bearers.
Exactly. It came with Sherpas.
Yeah. Why did you start collecting these monstrosities?
Initially, I was like any typical artist student living in New York and was moving from living situation to living situation, and a boombox was an easy way to have a music device. And so when I moved to New York, I went to 42nd Street, as someone does, and bought a boombox. Mm-hmm. And that and a futon, and that was my nomadic lifestyle.
But the idea of collecting them, I mean, it's not just... That was a very practical reason that you got your first one.
Exactly.
To have more than 50 of them, to have put out this book looking at them as a kind of artifact as opposed to a music device. Obviously, your position on these instruments, and they are sort of instruments of a sort, has changed.
Absolutely. It just began as a short interest, and then I found another one. And then at the time, I was traveling a lot across the U.S. and going to places like Detroit or Charlotte, North Carolina, which were kind of in the peripheral of hip-hop culture or even just music culture, but you were finding these kind of debris of this era in thrift shops.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you stumble across a JVC M70 in great condition. You're like, for $10, I can't turn that down. And so it began 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then I was using them as props and shoots.
Mm-hmm.
And then the idea of a collection just grew out of that, and then the idea of a book eventually.
So in writing the book, you had to wrestle with questions of, what is the enduring kind of importance? What are these icons of?
They really became a symbol of rebellion. They became a symbol of being outspoken, about creativity, about friction, heat, gathering. You hear all these great stories of people, how they gathered around these like a sonic campfire. And there's where they shared moments of either love or their hometown team winning a triumph, either in a nationally televised or broadcast game, to hearing that great song that defined that particular summer at that moment. A lot of people heard it through a boombox the very first time.
So in the intro to your book, Spike Lee talks about the boombox giving way to the Walkman and the iPod, but those are individual listening devices. The boombox was really a communal one, as you say, the sonic campfire.
Yeah, no, it was really a tribal device in a sort of way. It was a way to really bring people together, start a party. And at that time, say in New York City, as people wanted to get out of their apartments, and the boombox was a way to untether yourself from that classic old stereo system, mm-hmm. or even cabinet-like stereo that was occupying a lot of people's living rooms.
How important was it? Well, LL Cool J, back in 1985, sang, or rapped, "I Can't Live Without My Radio." These days, he's hosting the Grammys, but back in 1985, LL Cool J was praising not just any boombox, Lyle Owerko, but his JVC, a picture of which adorns the cover of this album called Radio. That was the JVC RCM-90. Is mm-hmm. that a particularly fetching example of a boombox?
Absolutely, absolutely. That was one of the best sounding and biggest boomboxes you could buy at the time. And people will argue that it is the best boombox of all time. It's a very simple device, but it sounds great. And when he says it'll vibrate the concrete, he's quite right.
There's actually a slideshow of some of Lyle Owerko's photographs of his boombox collection and his dog Luna on the Soundcheck webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Now, before we get too far from the LL Cool J song, if you were listening closely, you heard him say things like, I play it on the street and even on the subway. And then he talks about, I almost got a summons, but then I ran away. This is 1985, not long after the Metropolitan Transit Authority here in New York outlawed playing radios on the subway. There had been no previous law. And I can remember as a kid, going to school on the J train, boomboxes everywhere. I mean, it was a loud, loud place to be on the New York City subways in the late 70s and 80s.
Absolutely. And it's interesting in writing the book and interviewing people, Rosie Perez talked about as soon as the train would come out of the tunnel and go above ground, especially on the way to Coney Island, all the boomboxes people would start tuning in to those particular radio stations at the time and tuning in to a singular kind of group gestalt radio play where that song of the summer, everyone would tune in and sync all their boomboxes together.
Well, but the strange thing about that is that one of the things about the boombox was it always had a cassette deck. So you could be underground, mm-hmm. not within range of a radio station and still be blasting your music.
Oh, yeah. And that's if you had a sense of defiance and wanted to defend who you were listening to at the time and really felt for it.
Mm-hmm. Now, how important was the boombox to the development of hip-hop?
Hugely important. It was one of the first instruments of hip-hop. And if you talk to anyone from that era, anyone, whether you're talking to the Adam Yauch from the Beastie Boys to Razzle from the Roots, they talked about being in their, you know, alone at their home in their bedroom and making pause mixes, which led to creating...
You'll have to explain. That's special use of the pause button.
It's special use of the pause buttons, especially in concert with a dual cassette tech, where you were taking a beat off of one tape, winding it, dropping it in on sequence on another tape, rewinding it back, dropping it, and creating these rudimentary beat structures. From that, you found some friend who could rap and had something to say and put it over top of that. And that's where a lot of the early collaboration started. And when you really hear a lot of the really incubated first music from that era was created on a boombox initially.
Right. My first experience of hip-hop was, again, riding the subways and hearing it coming out of these boomboxes, early boomboxes, before they got so massive. Our listener Benjamin says, "You just checked eBay, and the Sharp SR-777 is still going for upwards of $999. Does that surprise you?
Not at all.
I mean, there are people who love their boomboxes. There are other people who do not have such fond memories of them. And Soundcheck listeners, which are you? What did you think of the boombox? Did you own one? Call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692. Or leave a comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. It's day three of our Super Collectors Week on Soundcheck, and Lila Werko, a photographer, owns a collection of these vintage boomboxes. He's also edited the book called The Boombox Project, The Machines, The Music, and The Urban Underground. Where do you keep all these things?
Oh, they're hidden all over the place in my apartment. They're in...
How do you hide the SR-777, which is almost as big as like a kitchen table?
Yeah, you have a big, deep closet. But really, for the most part, a lot of them are still on display to some regards on shelves. And the interesting thing that's now happening with my collection because of the book is cultural institutions are reaching out and asking for them for their collections. So,
do they work?
Yeah. Yeah, most of mine are in great working condition. If the decks don't work, the radio still works, guaranteed. And these devices were actually really well made. They're 30-plus years old, and they're constructed very heavily, very well, and still in working condition.
Now, working condition for a boombox is not the same thing as, say, working condition for your iMac or something like that. In fact, there's a composer here in New York named Phil Klein. I don't know if you know his stuff.
Absolutely, and I reached out to him when I was working on my book.
Okay, Phil is probably best known for a piece he does every Christmas season here in New York and in other cities around the world called Unsilent Night. It's one of a number of pieces that Klein has done for multiple boomboxes based on the premise that you can hand out a dozen boomboxes or 20 boomboxes to people, have them all press play at the same time, and the machines will all go slightly out of sync and out of phase with each other. This is the resulting kind of cloud of sound from Phil Klein's seasonal Christmas piece called Unsilent Night. So what you're hearing is a simple tape loop of some bells and before that some voices, but because they're being played on multiple boom boxes, they're all going out of sync, out of phase with each other. The music of Phil Klein from his Unsilent Night. My guest is Lyle Awerko, who has a collection of about 50 or so of these vintage boom boxes now being loaned out to various cultural institutions. So yes, the boom box. Often derided back in the day by people who thought of them as just loud, intrusive ways for the kids to make them listen to their music, now considered kind of cultural artifacts of a bygone era. Let's see what some of our Soundcheck listeners have to say about the boombox. Jules is with us from Long Island. Hey, Jules.
Hey, how you doing? I love your show.
Thanks.
Yeah, when I was a kid in my early teens, we used to break dance on Long Island, and the boombox was essential. You understand? Because I remember the, all the lights used to light up, and it would become like another part of the performance. And it would be, you know, just, I mean, it still to this day, when I see one, I get a little emotional. I gotta admit.
So when you were breakdancing, it wasn't just providing you with your soundtrack. It was kind of like, it sounds like it was your set.
Exactly. You know, and you would travel with it. And if you had like a dope boombox, that would give you even more rep out there.
Wow. How many, I mean, of these, Lyle, you said yours are all in pretty much working order. Lots of bells and whistles, lots of blinking lights. Are they colorful to look at?
Absolutely. That's part of the fun. You know, it's like having an LED that lights up a bit like a small Christmas tree.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the most beautiful parts of them.
Elizabeth is on the line with us from Montclair, New Jersey. Elizabeth, you got a memory of boom boxes?
Well, we always took the boom box down the shore to listen to music. And we were newly married and didn't have a lot of money. And we get down there one weekend, and the batteries had died. And my husband unhooked the car battery and hooked it up to the boom box on the beach. People walked by, stared, laughed at us, but there was no question we were gonna hear our music.
Wow! And he managed to do this without destroying either the boombox or himself.
Well, he was an electrician. He knew how to do it. But I was so scared. If that car did not start again when in that heat, I would have not been a happy camper.
So the batteries, Lyle. I mean, this is even that LL Cool J song we heard. Mm-hmm. You know, is like. Everybody talks about battery life. It's like the cell phones today, you know. This was the big thing. It's like you had to have – Spike Lee talks about this in his foreword to your book. It's not just that the things were big and bulky. You had to really invest in batteries.
Absolutely, and that was part of the big expense of them. You hear such great stories about the battery collection money situation coming up when a bunch of people are gathered in a park and like someone being like – Yo, you got to hook up, you know, like everyone got to throw down and throw in for some batteries. And then everyone's like, screw that. And then, you know, the guy with the box picking up his box and like, OK, I'm out of here then. And then everyone like, you know, reaching deep in their pockets and pulling out money for those batteries. And it's interesting when you hear this woman talk about hooking up to a car battery, because when you really travel, like in Brazil, where I see people with little hand trucks with a boombox type device hooked up to a car battery and bringing that down to the beach. Like, that's a professional.
Wow. We're speaking with Lyle Iwerko. He's one of our super collectors this week on Soundcheck. He has a collection of vintage boomboxes. He's also editor of the Boombox Project, The Machines, The Music, and The Urban Underground. And you can see images of his collection on our webpage. And the collection itself, the photos, the photo gallery of your collection is still up and running at the Click Gallery.
Absolutely.
Which is at 255 Center Street in Lower Manhattan through when?
It's running indefinitely.
Okay.
People like boomboxes and they like these pictures of them.
Well, they like them now. We mentioned Spike Lee a couple of times. In Spike Lee's 1989 film Do the Right Thing about race relations in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, it features this character, Radio Raheem. He's a kind of prophet who walks around the neighborhood with a huge boombox. And in one scene, he wins a boombox battle through the sheer volume of this Public Enemy track, which he blasts throughout the film. Public Enemy, Fight the Power, and in the Spike Lee film, Do the Right Thing, you hear a lot of this song, and you see a lot of people hitting that bass button that a lot of the better boomboxes have that would give you this sort of supercharged bass sound. Bob's on the line with us from right here in Manhattan. Bob, you got a boombox story for us?
Yes, I saw an amazing thing back in the 80s. A few boys had gotten two boomboxes, and they had set them up on either side of Amsterdam near the intersection of 96th Street. and I'm tuned to the same radio station, and they had a Frisbee, and they were playing Frisbee to the rhythm of the boomboxes. The music was filling the street. The cars were whizzing by. They were bouncing the Frisbee off of windshields of cars, you know, shooting bang shots around cars. I'm sure the police, you know, I've never seen it again. I'm sure the police frowned on it, but it was just, it was like a choreographed event. You know, music everywhere, these boys moving and dashing along the sidewalk, the Frisbee flying. It was really something to see.
And again, sort of echoing what our earlier caller, Jules, said, the boombox not just providing the soundtrack, but part of the theater, part of the live performance of this impromptu, or maybe not so impromptu, game of Frisbee that Bob's talking about. Sal is with us from Sayville in New York. Hey, Sal.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good.
I love your show right off the bat. I love your show. Listen to you every day.
Thanks. What you got for us?
All right. Back in the early 80s, I was in the Coast Guard on a buoy tender stationed out of Governor's Island, New York.
Mm-hmm.
A guy walks on the boat. He gets stationed on the boat. And in one, over one shoulder is his sea bag. Over the other shoulder is this monstrosity, 3 foot long, 6 inch wide, 1 foot tall boom box.
Well, at least you knew the guy was healthy and in good shape.
Yeah, well, he was healthy. But then he proceeded to play the worst music at the loudest levels.
All right, Bob, Sal, I'm going to have to ask you to define worst music.
Disco. All right, now this is the early 80s. Now, I'm sitting there, I'm a punker from the 70s.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sitting there listening to the Sex Pistols and the Clash and Television and all that, and all of a sudden, down from the birthing area, at a deafening volume, comes Donna Summers. And it just drove us crazy.
And you're on a boat.
And we're on a boat, a 180-foot boat. There's only 60 people living on this boat. And we were underway for months at a time. And no matter what we did, no matter where we were, here comes this, you know, disco blasting at unfathomable volumes.
All right, Sal, that's a great story, a sad story. I'm sorry to be laughing at your long ago pain. Lots of people wanting to get their voices into the conversation, talking about boom boxes of old. Joel Myers got some of the comments.
John, our listener Jay Freely posted this. Believe it or not, I'm listening to WNYC on my old boombox right now. I could be listening on my MacBook Pro, but I'm still impressed by the great sound this Samsung broadcasts. Kevin from Grosse Pointe, Michigan writes, how would anyone be able to breakdance now on the iPod? And Annie writes, my 18-year-old just got an iPod station with a tiny speaker, but it looks just like a boombox. Big, but light, yet still retro.
All right, so Lyle, as we, you know, as we look over the photos on the website of these various boomboxes and stuff, why do we still care today? The age of the boombox is a good 25 years in the past now.
I think it's the memories attached to it. It's like anything. Like, I think, say, in the 80s, I remember when kids that I knew, their fathers went and got old jukeboxes and put them in the basement and looked back at that, and they loved that because there was all the memories attached to it. For me, I have so many memories attached myself personally to boomboxes, which so many other people that, you know, grew up in that era did. And we heard,
well, what about poor Sal out on the boat with the guy blasting the disco on? I mean, he's got memories of boomboxes too, but he's probably not running out to see your collection of photos of them.
He might not be, but he might be. You know, he
true
may
enough
have heard the Clash and Television and Sex Pistols the first time on a boombox. Unfortunately, it wasn't on the boat he was on.
We've been speaking with Lyle Iwerko, photographer and photojournalist, who owns a collection of these vintage boomboxes and has edited the book called The Boombox Project, The Machines, The Music, and The Urban Underground. You can see the photo exhibit of his collection at the Click Gallery on Center Street in Lower Manhattan. Lyle, a pleasure to have you with us on our Super Collectors series today.
Thanks for having me in.
This is Soundcheck. Yes, the front and back. You would think it was a party, not a Cadillac. In a moment, our Super Collectors series takes us all the way to China. And then later, a preview of the latest album from sax player Ben Wendell and his band. We'll have a live performance on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now in our week-long series called Super Collectors. We're profiling people with large and or unusual collections of music and memorabilia, like the New York artist Rutherford Chang, who owns 500 vinyl albums. Now, compared to other record enthusiasts, that's a pretty small number. But Rutherford's collection consists solely of one title, the self-titled album released by the Beatles in 1968. That's right, Rutherford Chang owns 500 copies of the White Album. We spoke to him yesterday by phone from Beijing, China, where Rutherford is living right now.
I assume you're probably aware of, you're familiar with the album and the cover, which is all white.
Right.
Except for a serial number stamped in the corner.
Right.
Its design is already basically a white square that presumes it's a unique object.
So you mentioned the serial numbers in the corner. Do those serial numbers change from copy to copy?
Yeah, they're unique. For first pressings, there are about 3.2 million copies, unique serial numbers. Every actual copy of the White Album has a unique serial number.
All 3.2 million of them?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. But what's really interesting to me is that 40-some years after the album was released, the albums are, in fact, very unique. All of the covers are worn and torn, written on, graffitied. People write their names. They're far from white anymore, and you can really see the history that they've been through.
So, but it seems like you're interested in the album almost as a kind of artifact of personal histories of all these different people, the people who've scribbled on them, the people who've manhandled their copies over the years, the people who've kept them in pristine condition. How did you get started with that?
I bought my first copy as a teenager at a garage sale. But I didn't really decide to get multiple copies until about 6 years ago. I've just been buying them on eBay since.
Well, where do you store them?
Well, so I've been living in China pretty much the entire time at collecting White Albums. So I actually have them shipped to a friend's house in New York where they're kept. And I actually only get to visit my collection when I'm back in New York. So, I don't spend much time with it.
Is New York originally your home?
Yeah. I've always imagined opening a record store that sells only the White Album. I don't want to sell any of my albums. I want to get more.
So maybe a store where you can sell your copy of the White Album to the proprietor. And that proprietor would be Rutherford Chang. He's got over 500 copies of the Beatles' White Album. Certainly one of the most unusual super collections that we've come across so far this week. Rutherford's on the line with us from Beijing, China. And Rutherford, I hope you get a chance to get back to New York and spend some more time with your collection. But thanks very much for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Great. Thanks a lot.
This is Soundcheck. Okay, now, as we just heard, Rutherford Chang is living in China, but his collection of the Beatles' White Album is stored in a friend's apartment here in New York, all 500 copies, in a Soho apartment. That extremely generous friend now joins us on the line. Her name is Anne Chen. Anne, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I guess the why question has been sort of the first question I've asked all these super collectors. It's going to be the first question I ask you. Why are you letting this guy store all his stuff in your apartment?
Well, I mean, he's a really good friend from college, and we've known each other for a really long time. I think it just came up during a conversation we were having that he was running out of storage space. I think he was keeping it at his sister's place, and I have some room in my apartment, and so I just said, you know, you can just send them to my place, and, you know, that stretched out over a number of years.
Now, did you know what you were getting into, that there were going to eventually be 500 copies of this thing in your apartment?
Well, I knew when we started talking about it, he said that he wanted to collect all pressings.
All 3.2 million of them.
Yeah, all 3.2 million. So, so you know, it's...
How in touch with reality is Rutherford, actually?
I would say he is.
So have you given him a deadline to get his stuff in order and out of your apartment?
I haven't, but I know that he's moving back to New York pretty soon, mm-hmm. so I imagine it's going to happen within the next year.
So Anne, during these years where you have been the keeper of this collection of Beatles White albums, do you have to, like, take care of them? Do you have to move them around, keep them clean, et cetera?
Not really. I mean, Rutherford comes back a couple of times a year, so then when he comes back, he comes over and... You know, he organizes them. They were on a shelf for a while, but then it kind of started growing, so he got some boxes, and so now they're in these white archival boxes just sitting in the corner.
Anne Chen, you are a saint. Very nice speaking with you. You can view a picture of Rutherford Chang's collection of 500 copies of the Beatles' White Album stored in Anne Chen's apartment. It's on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org. And thanks for talking with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is Soundcheck. Still to come, jazz sax player Ben Wendell and his quintet will play live. And don't forget to get your tickets for our upcoming live show in the Green Space on Monday, February 27th. We'll be joined by the hip-hop MC Yasin Bey, formerly known as Mos Def, as well as the Robert Glasper Experiment and R&B artist Bilal. All of them coming to the Green Space Monday, February 27th at 2 p.m. for soundcheck. Hope you'll come too, but tickets are going fast. Get them at wnyc.org/soundcheck. Again, super magic, black origin, crush me out of dopeness, step me out of dopeness, sketch another opus, black opus, set, come close and get them open. Give it here, let it go. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Sax player Ben Wendell is a busy guy. First of all, he doesn't just play the sax. On his upcoming second album called Frame, he also plays the bassoon and the melodica. And he's been known to tickle the ivories on occasion as well. In addition to leading his own group, Ben Wendell's a member of the New York-based jazz rock band Kneebody, which you're hearing in the background. He also composes music for film, and a few years ago, he toured the country with a young rapper named Snoop Dogg. Ben Wendell and his quintet are here today in the studio to play live for us. This song is called Corral, live on Soundcheck. That's Ben Wendell and his band live on Soundcheck with Chorale. The new album is called Frame, and it comes out on February 28th. You heard Ben Wendell playing the sax, Ben Street playing the bass, Tigran Hamasyan playing our piano, Nir Felder playing the guitar, and Nate Wood behind the drums. Ben Wendell, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John.
So that really is kind of a chorale, that piece, at least at the beginning and end, with like all the quote-unquote voices massed together and moving through a progression of chords.
Totally.
Is that something that you've taken from like the classical music world? Because I know you've sort of dipped a toe in those waters too.
Yeah, I was raised by an opera singing mom and always had a lot of classical music in my life, and I feel like that's always been a part of how I write, mm-hmm. so definitely.
And then with the other band, Kneebody, which I described before as a jazz rock band, but you could almost pair any two musical genres together and it would be an apt description. I mean, it seems like, you know, avoiding easy descriptors has been a kind of a hallmark of your career so far.
Yeah, it's kind of maybe a blessing and a curse a little bit, but I don't know. You know, I think everybody here in this room and generally speaking about instrumentalists nowadays, we seem to be just like a sum of whatever we enjoy, and that tends not to be one specific thing. So,
right. So what did you, I mean, growing up with an opera singing mom, what else were you listening to?
Well, it was a really weird mix. Basically, I had a LP player that had a radio and a tape player. So I had, there was a hip-hop station called K-Day. It was an AM station.
So where was this?
This was back in Los Angeles. Uh-huh. And so I was listening to a lot of hip-hop. I was listening to a lot of classical music. And then my neighbor was a huge jazz fan and would just give me Charlie Parker and Coltrane tapes and LPs. So that was, generally speaking, that was like the blend that I was growing up on.
And then you ended up out on the road with Snoop Dogg.
Yes, I did.
What do you remember, if anything, from that?
Well, actually, it was a really fun experience, actually. It's really surreal to grow up listening to artists on the radio and then to get to play with them. And I really enjoyed it. It was, in a weird way, touring with him reminded me of the stories I've heard about touring with like jazz artists back in the day, where things were like really loose and but in a really cool, spontaneous way.
When was that?
That was in 2004.
Mm-hmm. So we were talking before about, you know, much earlier in the history of hip-hop when we were talking about boom boxes and stuff.
Yeah.
It sounds like the thing that you were describing a moment ago isn't quite a boom box because it had a turntable built into it.
That's true, but I did have a boom box.
You did have a boom box.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did you strut down the street, you know, blasting your
no.
jazz and opera?
No, definitely not. Sorry.
We're speaking with Ben Wendell. The sax player is leading his band in a CD release show this Friday and Saturday at the Jazz Gallery here in New York. Sets are at 9 and 10:30. The album's called Frame. I mean, Chorale seemed to be a considered, well-considered title. What about Frame? What does that refer to here?
I guess a lot of this music was written in the last 2 years. I moved here 2.5 years ago, and it sounds terrible saying this, but it was kind of like it's kind of a frame of mind or a frame of reference. So, you know, it's a lot of this music is just kind of reflecting the experiences of moving from the West Coast to the East Coast and the different emotions that come up in doing that, you know, mm-hmm. both a lot of excitement and anxiety and fun and all those kind of things. So
a lot of the music has, you know, it has kind of layers to it. I mean, it's a complex kind of music, I guess, reflecting the complex welter of emotions you have living in.
Yes, you're doing a better job of yes to what you said.
All right, then I'm going to let you do what you do best and play the title track from the album Frame. It's the latest from Ben Wendell and the Ben Wendell Group. They are playing for us live on Soundcheck. Thank you. This is Ben Wendell and his group performing live the title track from his forthcoming record, Frame, and they'll be playing live this Friday and Saturday at the Jazz Gallery here in New York. And that's going to do it for Soundcheck today. On our next program, we want to help solve your digital music collection conundrums. Super Collectors continues with experts answering your questions about digital music, from converting vinyl to storing files. Plus live music from New York psycho disco group The Phenomenal Handclap Band. That's on Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us today. Join us next time for more.